You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, this is Meg Riley coming to you today from a hotel room at the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago, where I am gathered with other teaching pastors and seminarians for the Meadville Lombard Convocation. We have two special guests today, Shauna Foster and Peggy Clark. I'll be introducing them, and we'll be talking about the Paris talks about climate change and global in a couple minutes. But first, I thought it'd just be fun to say, hey, Hank, you're there. Want to introduce yourself? You got trouble, my friend.
What's happening?
There you are. Hey, where are you besides tech hell?
I don't know. What's going on?
No, not that. All right, here's our intro question today. We won't talk about the weather. What happened that was cool over the holidays for you? Because we've been gone for 2 weeks. So anything, a great gift, a great trip, anything. Aisha, what you got?
We went for me, the first time visiting the San Juan Islands, which are right off the coast, in the Puget Sound. And I've been here 2.5 years, and it was my first time to Orcas Island. We went for Christmas night to a resort there, which allowed dogs. You could take your dogs almost everywhere in this area. I've genuinely never seen anything like it. Supermarkets. So we brought our dogs, all six of us, and it was fun. We had Christmas dinner at a resort on Orcas Island, so it was cool. It was a nice Christmas night. We just went for one night. Oh, there's my puppy now.
Hank, how about you?
I can speak for Hank. So Hank went to Texas. It was the most fulfilling experience of his life. A wonderful Christmas. He now believes in Santa Claus.
He got cowboy boots, didn't he?
Yes, I saw that. Absolutely.
And a gun.
As soon as you cross the border, they issue you one.
Oh, good.
Is this working? Am I on now? Can I stop you guys from talking about me?
You got your voice. Tell us.
Oh, here we go. Had a great holiday. Our girls are still, 8 and 11, so that was great. We made plans to go on the American Mecca of Disneyland and presented the girls mouse ears, which was, the big meltdown excitement. And had all the family up. It was great. It was really just had a wonderful, really wonderful and amazingly restful holiday. I mean, two huge services here on Christmas Eve, but then got a chance to relax and kick back and all that stuff. And before I say anything else, Shauna, happy birthday.
Happy birthday. Can I tell a funny story about Christmas Eve? I promise you won't be disappointed. So I led Christmas Eve service because we still don't have a minister. We are getting one soon. And it was my first time. I've been a religious educator for 12 years. I've never led Christmas Eve service. It was actually great. I read the story from the Quran of the Jesus' birth and him talking to his mother as an infant. Anyway, after the service, an elderly woman said to me, oh, my grandson wants to see the baby Jesus. And the first thought that popped into my head is, why on earth would we have a baby Jesus here? But I didn't say that, because I'm learning to monitor what comes out. And instead I said, the baby Jesus is home waiting for Santa, is asleep home waiting for Santa. And then I said it, and she looked, and even the three-year-old looked at me like, and she's like, okay, Merry Christmas. And then she looked. I said that. That happened. Yeah.
And as our former executive director, Lorraine Dennis, used to say frequently, and no small children were harmed. But maybe they were in this case. We're not here, actually. Tom, what about you?
Well, we went to New England because my L.A. daughter moved to Providence, Rhode Island. And so all my kids now are in New England. And so we went there and had Christmas at various people's houses. So that was really good. It was a chance to see all of them at once, which actually didn't turn out to be true because, the in-law split, the kids were in Florida. It was, you know, Christmas in America.
Do you feel pulled back to New England now?
Yes, we do. We will be going back there. We will be going back.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Sometime probably within the next 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and I haven't been with Hank since Thanksgiving. And, you know, Hank, I preached at your mom and dad's and sister's church the day after, the Thanksgiving weekend. And they were very nice to me, your mom especially. She's a charming, charming person. And your sister, who's your twin. And it was a great experience. Nice church.
My mom talked about that and talked about how, because your brother is a member of, and he was such a fantastic preacher. It was so great. But it is unsettling because he looks so much like his brother.
Yeah, except kind of like if you took my brother and went right like that, squashed him down and spread him out, that's me, and rubbed all the hair off his head. Otherwise, we'd look alike.
There you go. Know? Speaking of siblings, Joanna, how'd it go with your four kids over the holidays?
Oh, it was great. We actually had a really good time, and I got a drone for Christmas. I haven't tried it out yet. It's a drone quadricopter with a camera. So I'm really excited because here at Live Oak we have a chalice pathway and we have a full labyrinth. And so to be able to take pictures, from up above, I think I have to register it or something. Ironically, guns not so much, but a drone with a camera, apparently I do have to register. So I got to find out about all that.
You will be bringing that
actually,
to GA.
Actually, drones could really...
You will be bringing that to GA. We will have the view broadcasting aerial views of the plenary.
Actually, this is how the Presidential Search Committee is going to announce the candidates. We're going to give an aerial view, and you have to guess.
Oh, they'll
say, who's in that building?
Out of the clouds, like God pointing his finger at them, going... We have chosen you!
Yes. And from now on, they each are going to have, all of them will have their own drone that follows them around constantly, relaying back news.
Live streamed their daily lives.
Now, was this a gift from Santa or from Tom? I'm curious.
Yeah, this was from Tom. Tom actually did, he was pretty amazing. This was from Tom, and then he also had won his... League of Dorks, fantasy football, and he used that money to get fourth row tickets, Willie Nelson. So I had a really good December 30th. Tommy Lee Jones was right across the aisle from us.
Oh my God, Tommy, wow, that's amazing. Well, he gets Husband of the Year, I think. That's pretty good. I had a very wonderful, mellow holiday. It just was perfect. It was so simple, which I really needed. And just different pieces. Saw Star Wars on Christmas, which was a blast. My 19-year-old was up when I got. I like wandered down at 8:30, figuring it might be 10 before I saw Gia. But Gia was up and. We were doing each other's stockings. I used to stay up. Never mind. We won't talk about that. Anyway, so it was just really fun. And and then I got sick. And that was New Year's Eve. And I was going to have out-of-town visitors and all that. And it just got very, very simple after that. Like, where's the Kleenex? Kind of simple. So I'm happy to be well again. More or less, NyQuil is still my best friend. But more or less good. And, that time when I was going to do all those things that made this travel all ready and all that, none of that happened. But, the house didn't fall apart. Well, that's fine. Well, let's move into our today's conversation. There's much that we could always talk about, but I have a feeling there's going to be a lot to say from this. So let me introduce our two guests. And then I would like it if each of you would share how you happened to go to Paris. But if you need to first tell a holiday story, we also always would love that. So Shauna Foster, some of you who are View fans will remember her because she used to do tech for The View back when she worked with us. Now works in Denver with a group called Padres and, I'm going to butcher that, Jovenes Unidas? No, did I get it? Okay. She's laughing at me.
It's Padres y Jóvenes Unidos, Parents Thank and Youth United.
You. That is just so much better than what I just said. For anti-racism in education, and would you want your kid to have a teacher like me? No. She went to Paris as a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and also as part of the Grassroots Global Justice, a group that is organizing people of color as the most impacted by climate change. So that will be wonderful to hear about both of those groups. Peggy Clark has been a guest here before, talking about the New York City demonstration for climate change last year. She is the minister at the First Unitarian Society of Westchester in Hastings-on-Hudson. Is that Pete Seeger's town?
No, close. No. Close.
He had Hudson in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same river.
Right. It's a big river. Peggy's also the Green Faith Senior Fellow, which I'm excited to hear about, and the Racial and Social Justice Consultant for the New York Metro District. She was one of the delegates at COP21 in Paris representing Unitarian Universalism. So that is all very exciting. Peggy, you're unmiked or unmuted. Why don't you start? Just tell us how it happened that you went to Paris.
You know, I'm wishing I had a great story. The truth is, I was talking to Bruce Knotts since the demonstration.
Who's
big
Bruce Knotts?
I'm sorry, Bruce Knotts is the executive director of the UU United Nations office, and he was helpful when we were creating the Faith Contingent for the People's Climate March in New York last September, a year ago September. So he and I were on the phone in spring, and we were talking about the relationship between anti-racism work and climate justice work and how necessary it is that we start to make this connection for Unitarian Universalists. And I said, you know, gee, wouldn't it be great if I could go to Paris and be part of COP21 and really bring that message back? And he said, why don't you go? I can credential you. And that, you know, I wish I had a better story than that, but that's really it. And,
well, that's and I, a good story. Well, then tell us what Green Faith Senior Fellow means.
So Green Faith is a national organization that trains religious leaders in environmental work, the idea really being if we want to move climate justice forward and environmental justice forward, we really need to be training our religious leaders. So the program, I'm in the class, I think I'm in class 2009, and a Green Faith Fellow, Reverend Wendy Bell and I were the first two UUs to become Green Faith Fellows, although now there have been dozens of them. At some point, Green Faith partnered with the UUA to make it free or virtually free for UUs to join the program so that we really built a strong group of leaders, religious environmental
leaders. If people
leaders.
Who are listening to this were interested in doing that, how would they apply or where would they look on the web?
Go to greenfaith.org and click fellowship.
Great. Thank you. And it's a training program?
It's a training program. I mean, in some ways it's a transformative training program, really making the connections that I think we all need to make if we're trying to shift our paradigms.
Great, thank you. We'll get back to you. Shauna, you came in for two different groups. So as is usual, you're usually wearing about 7 or 8 hats wherever you go. But how did you happen to go to Paris?
Yeah, so I came to Paris as more of an anti-racist, anti-oppression sort of lens. So I actually don't have that much background in climate justice. There's a group out there called Grassroots Global Justice that is organizing groups of people who are the most affected by climate change. Because if you look at climate change, actually I remember my professor at Meadville, Kiyama, telling me there's no such thing as a natural disaster because we know these things are going to happen. We know where it's going to happen. We are able to plan for these kinds of things. So with that, Grassroots Global Justice, their theme is no war, no warming, and build an economy for the people on the planet. And I'm on the board for Iraq Veterans Against the War, being a veteran myself, also being against the war. And they're one of the groups, they fulfill the no war part of that slogan. So we got invited, they were putting together a delegation to go to Paris. And so we were invited to send 2 members, and they brought us to be on the outside of the COP to really try and pressure for indigenous rights, for the rights of people of color, to really to keep fossil fuels in the ground. So that's how I got to Paris.
This is a weird tangential question, but the war at this point, is that the war on terrorism, or what is the war at this point?
You know, that is, it's you know, it's super relevant after September 11th and with how illegal the Iraq War was, but we have expanded to Afghanistan also being a continuous, the longest war that the United States has fought in recent history. And we're shifting, though, because a lot of the wars have been privatized. Majority of people who are fighting them are now contractors. So it's not even like something that the public is owned or invested in anymore. It's more like governments doing things for multinationals that are too big to fail. So the concept of war has even really seriously changed, and climate change has a lot to do with that as well. So I'll be happy to talk about Iraq Veterans Against the War and climate change specifically, and how that all feeds into this system.
Perfect. Yeah. And Peggy, also, we should say that you're on the steering committee for Commit to Respond. So that's also an important connection to bring in. So, I mean, yeah, the interconnections here are pretty staggering. I mean, Peggy, you're doing the anti-racism work too. And so let's start there. Like, talk about, from both of your perspectives, why should people who care about racial justice being paying careful attention? And in Paris, was that something that a lot of people were talking about, or were you guys kind of feeling marginalized with that lens?
Well, I can. Oh, Peggy, do you want to go first?
Yeah, go.
Yeah, I mean, I could say that the group that I was with felt very marginalized. The Indigenous Environmental Network was one of the big players that came in that said, because part of the COP agreements, one of the things, and I'm sure Peggy can explain this better because I was just, you know, a newcomer into this, was something called the RED agreements. And it's basically a carbon market where you can offset carbon credits. And one of the things that you can do to offset those carbon credits is seize land. So like the Sarayaku is an indigenous tribe from Ecuador, indigenous peoples in Canada that are battling pipelines. They have been fighting government takeovers in the name of these multinationals of their land forever. I mean, since white colonization of the Americas. And they can't, now with the RED agreements, they feel like it's a justification for a carbon offset for them to be able to come and take the land. And that's in the Paris Accord. So they definitely felt, the indigenous people especially, felt super, super marginalized. And they actually have a plan for a just transition.
I'm going to back you up. I think you're presuming that we're a lot smarter than we are.
Yeah.
Can you just back up and just say that like you'd say it to your kid? Because that would be me. Like, with that. Like just.
So the carbon exchange market is the idea that for so much carbon you pollute into the atmosphere, you can do things to mitigate that, to offset it so it's not a true zero, not zero emissions, but a net zero. So that whatever you're putting in the atmosphere, the idea is that they could buy a forest and they could count all of the carbon cleaning that forests do, or they could build a solar cell farm, and that solar farm would reduce emissions by this much. So there's this idea at the COP of like a net zero, which the frontline communities completely reject, because they say unless 80% of all fossil fuels are kept in the ground, from their analysis, then we can't stop global warming and we can't stop the total destruction of the planet. So there is no such thing for the groups I was with as net zero. It's not going to work. And so so not only do they have the carbon exchanges that we don't think is going to work, but they now have part of those carbon exchanges as land grabs. So that is also extremely unfair.
Part I don't quite get.
Okay. From what I hear Shauna saying, and tell me if I get this wrong, just to feedback what I'm hearing here, is that by acquiring land, they can say this land has a positive effect, say it's a forest, has a positive effect, and that counterbalances their pollution other places. But to the people who own that land now, or the native people who have that land, that's just, they lose the land.
I think a prime
I don't get. How do corporations grab the native land?
Well, I think a prime example is the hydroelectric dams in Brazil. Okay. That's a green energy project. That would be a carbon offsetting project. And, you know, since the 60s and 70s, they've been putting those hydroelectric dams that completely flood the indigenous lands and the people's way of life. And those people have been fighting the Brazilian government, you know, for as long as colonization, to keep their land and their way and not be pushed off of their land. But what I was hearing from the Indigenous Environmental Network is that these land grabs could be as like them just buying a forest, not even putting a green project on it, but taking the forest as their green project. And they could raise all the trees off of it, plant GMO trees, and burn those trees as biofuel. And that would be a carbon offset. So they just, you know, so it's just to them a bunch of greenwashing that still allows corporations to get at their goal, which is to extract every single piece of fossil fuel under the ground, because it's $4.2 trillion worth of money under there. And this Paris Accord allows them to keep going at it through a carbon offset scheme.
Thank you. I'm hoping that I'm not speaking only for myself when I keep asking, like, please clarify. Okay, so
no, it's great, yeah.
Clearly that's one thing about the agreements that the Indigenous people were very unhappy about. Were there, I mean, I overall, as you can see how really I'm not your super educated person, felt like generally really happy that something happened, that there was some agreement. Was that generally true that with the people who were there? And are there pieces that, even with the Indigenous piece, were there pieces both with a racial justice lens and just with a lens of just being there that you felt good about? Or, Shauna, for you, did that outweigh all the good stuff?
It didn't help people of color. Usually the United Nations helps people of color, Indigenous communities, have some sort of negotiating rights in these multinational situations. And the COP didn't give them any leverage. It gave them less leverage. So from grassroots global justice's point of view, and the It Takes Roots delegation, no. I mean, there's nothing stopping that extraction from happening that's going to kill the planet. You're adding on the land grabs. So from being there, there was nothing that they appreciated about it. Oh, Peggy, do you want to address a question in the comments about what exactly the COP is and what it was like to be on the inside? Because I don't know what it was like to be on the inside, which I'm sure is a totally different perspective. So
I think it is. But one of the things I'm thinking, Shauna, while you're talking, is that one of the things that I see happening is that we are not addressing the patterns that created the crisis. So that what we're doing is creating solutions that don't require transformative action and instead really allow us to continue to live in denial and to continue to live with a paradigm that isn't working. So we're pushing the necessary transformation off to another generation yet again, so that you can see we perpetuate the injustice because we haven't really dismantled the paradigm. That's not the question, but that's what I'm thinking while you're talking.
You got to break that down some, though, Peggy. Okay. Come on.
Okay.
I mean, that's like, yeah.
Keep it with your kids.
Sometimes I live so in my head, and I know what I'm talking about, so that's good. Okay, so this is what I mean. What I mean is that we have created a paradigm that supports a dominant class, right? So there is a group where we're talking globally, we're talking really about Americans, we're talking about white Americans, male Americans, straight Americans. There's this dominant class, and really we have a paradigm that forces or creates the possibility for everyone to be in service to a dominant class. The current paradigm means that the planet and animals and plants and trees and air are also in service to the dominant class. So, for instance, at the turn of the last century, there was a move to make the songbird was going extinct, and there was a move to protect it. And all of the arguments to protect it were about how beautiful the music was of the songbird. In other words, this is a service to us. We like the songbird, so the songbird should exist, rather than the songbird has a right to existence on its own. So we have created this paradigm, and we are perpetuating the paradigm, even with the Paris Agreement, which I would say was a success and had a lot of really positive things coming out of all of this. But it doesn't challenge the paradigm. It didn't require transformation of culture. So that what it has done is continued the kind of injustice that Shauna is talking about. It didn't require us to rethink the way that we live. It simply used our current paradigm that discredits a huge portion of the population of this planet and continues to keep them in service of the dominant class. Does that make more sense?
It does, but then in what way do you see it as a success? Because from what Shauna said, it doesn't sound like a success, but I want to understand where you see it as a success.
So, first of all, there was an agreement. The possibility that there wasn't any agreement was high. Halfway through, I'd say 6 days through, it was on the table that everyone was going to go home. Nothing was going to happen at all. And apparently that happens regularly at these things. And in the past, everyone has gone home. I mean, Kyoto was a long time ago. It's been a long time since there's been any agreement at all, even any common ground around that we need an agreement. So that the planet's leaders agreed that we need to do something, that climate change is real, it is human-made, it is creating a disaster that we can change, we can affect. Just that common ground, an agreement to that, is big. That we walked out with an agreement that actually talks about the possibility of 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures rather than the 2 degrees that has become the norm. That language is, that's big. That the indigenous people, and I'm completely in agreement with Shauna across the board, and that is my experience on the inside as well. But countries, the developing world, and language of justice for the developing world was persistent. Language like ambition was persistent, accountability. There's a section right now in the document on loss and damage. There were two options when we started, that there would not be any section on loss and damage or that there would. And that was big. That's never been true before. And loss and damage is all about how do we help developing nations who are the most affected. So there is language in there that's good. And the INDCs, which is the intentional nationally determined contribution, so each country decides for themselves how it is that they're going to meet the agreement, that's also really big, so that it becomes a little bit more of a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach, which is a new way of doing this and has the potential of being more effective than Kyoto did. So in that ways, it was successful.
I'm going to pause and just ask about what agreement means for the United States, because one thing I've learned is that while other countries really see international UN-based stuff as a commitment and a covenant, the U.S. sees it as optional. With new leadership here, will those new standards and will all of that hold firm? I mean, is this irrevocable agreement, or could someone say, oh, we don't care, you know, we're cowboys, no offense, Joanna, but you know what I mean? Like, is it a long-term, like, irrevocable agreement we've got going here?
That's a really good question, and in some ways still an open question. I will say that in the first week, 10 Democratic senators showed up and made a big display of saying, we support our president, we support this process, and, you know, thank you all for being here, and we're looking forward to it, which I thought was odd until I learned that there were 10 Republican senators who were planning to make the same trip the next week, shortly before the finalization of the document, to say exactly the opposite, to say, it doesn't matter what you do here, we don't support our president, we don't support this process, and it's never going to happen. So there was this fear from the Americans that I met of embarrassment, if nothing else. But you know what? It didn't happen. It never happened. The 10 Republicans didn't show up. The rumor was that they realized it would look ridiculous. There are definitely parts of this for which we need our Congress. There's a Green Climate Fund that needs, in our current budget that's right now being debated, needs $500 million in our budget. And our Congress can control that. And if we don't put that in, other countries are unlikely to put their share in. So change of regime will be huge in this.
I'm curious about technology. Were there any, I know that India and France had been talking about solar power and about having some, you know, connections about that. Were there any other technology advances that people were talking about? I mean, like, I was surprised recently when I learned that, or at least here in the U.S., it seems like most environmental engineers kind of sneer at wind farms and say, you know, okay, for the amount of energy you have to put in them, it's really not worth it. Were you hearing any sort of conversation about, I guess, really not even technology, but alternate forms of energy?
Well, yes. So right now, for instance, in Iceland, they've determined that, I think it's by 2025, there will not be any fossil fuel burning cars on the island anymore. And so Shell has stepped up and they're creating hydrogen. They have already created hydrogen powered cars. There's all kinds of innovations like that. There was, I think, a real reliance on the idea that technology is going to save us, although there were a good number of people there saying, specifically in the faith contingent, saying we need to be careful about the sort of shiny penny thing. The one that worried me the most was less about energy and more about food, the reliance on GMOs was, and here this is another place where injustice comes in. While GMOs might be something that farmers in this country, at least major industrial farmers in this country, can afford, it's not something that most farmers around the planet can afford. So if we're relying on GMOs to create drought-resistant crops, then we're talking about leaving out 75% of the farmers on the planet.
Yeah, I definitely think the shiny penny thing was kind of something that was happening in the grassroots groups as well, because what we were seeing is new technological ways to justify dirty methods, like saying there's such a thing as clean fracking, or there's such a thing as biofuels, which is burning trees and increasing carbon emissions. So it was a little technological justification more so that I saw in the realm of innovation than true. And it was interesting because what we saw was a co-opt of like the grassroots messaging. So they're like, this is 100% renewable, burning trees. And it's like, that is not what we mean when we say 100% renewables, right? And so there's a lot of stuff, and then there's also technology and cleaning up the mess too, like being able to clean up the oceans, being able to clean up oil spills, being able to clean up, and we were kind of like, if you don't take this stuff out of the ground in the first place, if you actually do a just transition to a 100% renewable economy, we don't really need these technologies. There's even like technologies to take the carbon emissions out of the air, and to clean it up that way, and clean coal and things like that. So I didn't feel from where I was at on the outside that there was a great technological innovations that we could trust about. There was a lot more justifications to keep the current paradigm going.
Well, hold on. Let's talk about this on the outside, on the inside thing. Like, what did it look like to be on the inside? Were you in a building? I mean, what were you inside of?
Yeah, it looked like
what were you doing?
So there was what's called the green zone and the blue zone. The green zone was for delegates. It was mostly, so COP is Conference of Parties. The parties are the countries or non-governmental organizations, which is what the Unitarian Universalist Association is. So that was... So I was a party. It looked like a small city. There were maybe 3,000 people there, and people were there. It was open 24/7. People were working, and they really were working around the clock, so it was always open. There were like 25, 30 places to eat. There was a massive press room. There, you know, it looked like people were working for 24 hours. And yeah, in order to get in, you went through an enormous amount of security. The green zone was on the outside of that space and had its own building. I was there only a few times. I'm sure Shauna could tell us more about the green zone. The green zone felt to me like every exciting music concert I'd been to. It was fun. Inside the blue zone, everyone was all dressed for work. It was a little, it was fun, but in a more buttoned up way.
nerdy.
Yeah, so on the outside, I mean, we were really concerned after the Paris attacks about the state of emergency, and they had a protest ban. So during that protest ban, they had it so there was going to be a climate march that was before the attacks was going to be a million people, and they couldn't do it because of the protest ban. So they put, I think, like some 30,000 shoes that would have shown the amount of people there. Sorry, Tom, that was my phone. It's still going. That would have shown all the people who were going to be able to march. A lot of the climate change activists that were in Paris were put on house arrest. The site where they put in the United Nations talks was a place where a lot of squatters were, because of French law, I guess, if you occupy some place for more than 30 days, it's yours or something. So they completely took out all of the people that were there. And it was interesting because they didn't acknowledge that those people own the places, but then when the people in protest went and camped in, like, the mayor or the governor's backyard, I forget which exactly, the electric company still found their encampments and sent them their bills. So, I mean, it was just like, you know, so the local population was not happy with how the security had to be handled, and so there was a lot of talk from being able to do it. And in the end, you know, people were like, we just have to do it. We can't come here. We can't be afraid by this state of emergency and the house arrests and all the things. And the police were asymmetrical. Like sometimes, some days they would just be like throwing everybody in jail. And then some days they would just be watching people to see, I think it was like, depending who was at work that day at the police station. So that was really hard to be able to plan actions. The big action came on December 12th. That's when all of the groups came together to, and that's when we thought maybe the accord would be announced. So all the big groups came together. I think it was like, there's like a couple big green groups, you know, like Greenpeace and 350.org, and then there's a lot of different smaller and frontline community groups. And so they were outside of the Arch de Triomphe, and we weren't supposed to march. We were just supposed to be there and have a huge red line that said, this is the red line that you can't cross. You have to keep it in the ground. And then our group was leaving to go to another action, and it was actually Via Campesina, and we were following them, and then they all followed us, and it ended up being a march to the Eiffel Tower that we weren't planning for, the police didn't know, so we were just kind of like, we're just going to keep walking as long as they let us keep walking. And so we ended up having the climate march after all, going from the Arch to the Eiffel Tower, and then they had, you know, more talks and things like that. So that was actually a really moving moment for me to see all of the people marching through the streets with that giant red banner that they hadn't planned to march with at all. That took a lot of coordination. Really seeing the amount of people rallying for it and cheering for trying to get something different at the Paris Accord agreements than what was going to be happening. And, you know, the thing I really appreciated about it is that we weren't just there to just criticize and say, you all suck and everything you do is awful. We actually had like solutions that we really wanted people to work on, which is the principles of just transition. There's like six principles of just transition that I could go through, but basically it's a just transition plan to move us off of a fossil fuel economy to a 100% renewable economy. And it costs, they have done the analysis, it costs $3.8 trillion. It would change the paradigm. And the thing is people are like, well, we don't have money for that. And then I was there to say, hey, you know what? These are wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have costed the world $3.6 trillion. So really, where are our priorities? We always, you know, it's like there's never money for education. There's always money for war. It was that kind of thing. It's like, you know, with the way the agreements were structured, it was the same. It was just a justification for them to continue on the same business, which from my point of view is war, because these multinationals need to be able to secure those resources and they need to be able to forcibly take those resources to protect their profit margins. And to do that, they need to keep on engaging in war. And so that's what I was talking to people about when I, for my part of the, you know, no war, no warming, building an economy for the people and the planet, it seems to me like it's the same old plan they've always had for climate change, which is war. I mean, while people here in the United States, politicians mainly, have been like, oh, there's no such thing as global warming, they have no problem giving tons of money to the Pentagon to plan for water wars 2020, to plan for these wars over scarcity of resources. And so, unfortunately, I didn't see a whole lot of change from that paradigm in the COP agreements, and the people in the frontline communities didn't see that either. But we do have an idea of what a just transition should look like and what we should be going towards. And I felt like all the arguments that say, well, we can't do it, it's too much of a change, I was like, well, when it's war, we are happy to change. I mean, the whole infrastructure of the United States changed in World War I and World War II. When we feel like it is for our very survival, we are able to change in pretty quickly. But the current, you know, the current interests in power, it doesn't serve them right now. So trying to continue to build those bridges so that everybody gets on the same page, that's what we've got to keep fighting for.
Piggy, how would you respond to that? I mean, you mentioned the paradigm change. The part about corporations giving up profits and power, that doesn't happen without a violent revolution, I don't think. I'm really curious if you, I mean, I've just never seen that in the world. If I look at what's happened in, happily not yet the U.S., but in many, many countries, how do you respond to what Shauna said from the inside?
I'm never on the inside, so it's funny you keep saying that. Well, you know, I'm listening to what you just said about corporations, and I actually think that what's going to happen is that as Americans change the moral norms and as we start shifting into a new way of understanding what we need to do, corporations will have to keep up. So I think about what happened in Iceland and that it's Shell that's making that change. Well, Shell is going to make a fortune by creating hydrogen-powered cars. I think any smart business is going to start making this shift because it will make the money. Now, that isn't quite the paradigm shift I wish we were making. I completely agree with Shauna that, in fact, I would say that we need a World War II scale effort. I think if we were to do that, we could do what needed to be done, which is 100% renewables by 2025. But we aren't going to do it if we're waiting for ExxonMobil to take the lead. We're going to do it if people start saying we need new infrastructure, we have to live differently, and then requiring something to happen. And that isn't really happening in this country. It's happening in other countries. And it's happening in this country in these tiny little pockets, right? The city of Portland, are any of you in Portland? So the mayor has declared that it's going to be fossil fuel free, I think, by 2025. As a city. Well, that sort of effort, and if we start to see other small enclaves doing that, then corporations start to pick up and paradigms, you know, it's not going to happen in the way that I want it to, which is the sort of revolution that I think we need, but it might happen slowly if we start demanding it. And the other piece of that, can I just say,
yeah,
is that I was really wildly impressed. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud. I'm hoping no one I went to college with can see me. But I was impressed with our State Department, the same State Department I'm always out protesting. But they were understanding things, frankly, that people even in my, you know, in our congregations aren't completely understanding. They were understanding the relationship between faith and climate change. They were understanding the requirement for justice in all of this. In fact, they told us, and this was a group of religious leaders were invited to the State Department and then to the White House for a meeting for 2 days. And one of the things that they told us is we need the faith community to push. You create the mandate for us. So first, government can never do everything. Second, the government only does what people are requiring it to do. And they said, if we want to really do something on climate change, the faith community has such a powerful voice. We're going to do whatever we do, and we're going to declare it a success because we have to politically. And then we need the faith community to keep pushing hard to require us to do more. So while I'm not seeing corporations make the shift that needs to be made, I was really heartened by our government.
And where would you see that leadership coming from if the faith community was going to really be the energy? Places like Green Faith, are they taking the racial justice stuff really seriously as they at this stuff?
And honestly, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so do you think, I mean, I'm always both delighted and a little scared when people are looking to the faith community to be the engine behind social change.
Well, you know, The faith community in this country is massive. Yes, I would say, actually, Green Faith made the connection for me, the environmental justice connection for me between racial injustice, which had always been my work, and environmental justice. So yes, and Green Faith has been a real leader in this. They were doing a pilgrimage to frontline communities in Europe right before, and then making big statements. They've done all kinds of things. But, you know, when we're sitting in that meeting, the American bishops, the American Conference of Catholic Bishops, the leader of, I don't know what his title is, was there. The leader of the Evangelical Conference, is it, was there. We're talking about huge groups. There, you know, someone from Catholic Social Services, the Presbyterians were on site, the Baha'i, the Quakers, talking about a lot of people. Because of the meeting we had in D.C., that group kind of got to know each other, and we were able to meet a good number of times at COB, and were able to negotiate as a faith community. So we had the ear of the State Department, which I need to say is by their invitation. I don't even know that we would have thought we could have created those possibilities, but they wanted to hear what we were thinking, and they were clear, they wanted our support, and so we were able to say, if these things aren't there, you don't get our support. So it's not us, Unitarian Universalists on our own, really don't have the power that we need. Everything we have to do moving forward is about collaboration, it's about interfaith work, it's really about how is it that we're going to partner, find our common ground, and create a bold, ambitious voice for climate justice?
One of the things I'd like to see in the narrative is that this is really about humanity's survival. Because George Carlin does a brilliant skit about it's not about saving the Earth. The Earth is going to, he says, shake us off like a bad cold and then begin to regenerate and heal. So I wonder if the narrative went from saving the planet to saving humanity, if that would at least begin to get people to get out of denial. Because I feel like that's what I say to people. I'm like, the Earth is going to be psyched when we're gone because we're just destroying it like a cancer. You know, we're the cancer of the Earth. So it feels like, you know, let's start talking about our survival. Do we want to continue as a species?
Yeah, one of the things that the sessions that I went to that was like, I don't know, the alternative COP, that they said was like, there's no jobs on a dead planet. And we need living jobs on a living planet. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, and that's what a just transition is all about. Because, you know, I come from a very poor family background. And to go to those people and being like, your mining job is a dirty job and you should just leave it. Like, that goes nowhere. And to the people who are the most impacted by climate change, to tell them that their livelihoods is bad. I mean, I was looking at maps of like the average income, and the highest average income in the state right now is North Dakota because of all of the energy jobs that are there, the dirty jobs. So we're going to tell all those folks, hey, you know what, no more job for you because it's bad for the planet.
People are heading for North Dakota from all over. I've gone up to look at those fracking communities. And, yeah, people who haven't had jobs for years are up there working for a lot of money.
So that's why we have to have a just transition. And, I mean, that was the real connection for me because I never really connected anti-war work or anti-racism work with environmental work before I went to Paris. And really talking about, like, a lot of the people who become military members is because they need a job. They need a way out of whatever community that they're in. And to tell those folks, like, well, we're, you know, there's no more wars anymore because we're a totally renewable economy, or you fought for oil and you're a bad person. Like, that just isn't going to, you know, that isn't going to make it. We need to have a way for the people who are the most impacted by climate change to be able to define what they need to be able to go and move forward and having living jobs on a living planet. And so it's just so much, you know, I used to think that environmental work was like, save the rainforest and save these endangered species, save the whales. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't care about that. But it really is about people. It really is about the people who have the land, about their livelihoods, about what we do as humanity on the planet to be able to live out our lives.
Well, if you look at the U.S. politically, basically the the, you know, the thread that connects the, you know, the reactionary, you know, population in the United States is fossil fuels. I mean, you could just overlay where is fossil fuel extraction going with red and blue counties, it matches up pretty close. I mean, there's a reason why Texas and Louisiana and all the way up through Kentucky and Tennessee and coal and all those things are so reactionary at this point, partly because of a cultural divide around, you know, the environment, and partly about, you know, exactly what you're talking about, Shauna, is like people's livelihoods and a sense of fear around those things, and a sense that the earth firsters are the, you know, the tree huggers or whoever you want to describe them are going to leave these folks behind. Are going to leave these folks behind, and when you start to look at it from the perspective of non-white people who are on the front lines, you begin to get another kind of take on that same situation.
And when you look at it from a global perspective, yeah, it's really staggering. It's really, really insanely staggering. So we have just a few more minutes, and I want to be sure, and because these are such huge things, I always want to come down to, so here we are, we're talking to Unitarian Universalists about these giant or they call them wicked issues. Where would you suggest people start? Like if a congregation that just is kind of where Shauna was before Paris, going, yeah, well, save the whales, whatever, who go, oh my God, this is a moment. This is a time to really act. What actions would you recommend people take to get up off of our Barca loungers?
So I think that there are a lot of things that we can do, and I'm happy to start listing them, but I also just want to suggest, and I know this is about to be completely unpopular, but while I completely agree with everything everyone is saying, on the other hand, I think we need to consider the possibility that the paradigm that has to shift actually levels these things so that it isn't so much about, like, who cares about the trees to the trees are as valuable as everything and everyone, that we have to really be thinking on a new from a new lens and a new paradigm and need to value all life. So just want to put that out there. But with that said, I think that our congregations lose the moral high ground.
Wait a minute. Are you hinting at like an interdependent web or something?
It's crazy. I completely understand the impulse to be human-centered, but I also understand that creates part of the crisis, that when we aren't valuing life, we aren't valuing life. So there is another way we might want to start considering looking at the world. With that said, though, I think our congregations need to do a few things. One of them is we really need to take seriously the possibility of alternative energy, and as silly as it sounds, and I am, until Paris, I have to say I really devalued wildly things like changing light bulbs. I have come to understand that actually changing light bulbs, solar panels, these things are making a real impact when we do it on a grand scale, and that it gives us a different moral ground, and it also allows people to try something that they haven't tried in their own lives, but to see how it works, and to sort of experiment in a safer way. I also think I chair our food justice ministry, the National Food Justice Ministry that came out of this statement of conscience on ethical eating. And I also think that if congregations were growing some of their own food, the food that we eat on Sundays, we would be reducing our carbon impact that way. And again, it allows people to try things out, learning how to live differently with each other. And massive recycling programs in our congregations, share programs, new ways of getting to church on Sundays, that kind of thing. Those are things, they're real, they're simple, they're sort of obvious, and I've discounted them far more than I think I should have. I think that those things make a real difference.
Can you, Peggy, this is actually a question I have for you. Like, what are the kinds of groups that UU congregations could join? I mean, I know of them, but I don't know which ones would be the best for helping congregations be part of not only the individual transition off of a fossil fuel economy, but being part of the building that, you know, building that pressure that the State Department says they need from the American people. What sort of groups should congregations be a part of to really help apply that change systemically? Who's already done the research about, like, I know there's bills coming up about extraction from the United States, oil wells and all those things, and it's, like, very complicated, but what kind of group could congregations get involved with that would help them be part of the systemic change?
So there are a few of them. If you go to moralmobilization.org, they are calling for a policy change that makes real sense to me, and congregations could sign on to that. I mean, a lot of congregations belong to Interfaith Power and Light, but they don't do policy work, although with that said, they seem to be shifting into a greater willingness to move in that direction. 350.org has tremendous voice in this country. Green Faith also, for congregations as a congregation to join Green Faith or to start thinking about training religious leaders through the fellowship program. And I would say that right now for Unitarian Universalists, our current campaign is Commit to Respond. It really is a campaign. It's not an organization, but we're moving into far more intentional partnerships so that we're creating a larger faith-based voice for climate justice. I think congregations, I think Unitarian Universalists could and should really sign on. So it's the committorespond.org and sign on to the website and become part of that movement. I think we can become effective.
So here, I'll just be honest. CLF signed on. Yeah, we like that. But I can't say we've actually done anything because of it. No. So after you sign on, then what happens?
Well, so here's my hope. My critique of Commit to Respond, and I say this because I've been honest about it, you know, to the steering committee, is that we haven't really done anything. We did a sort of cool climate justice month last year, and that was it. And if you're part of Commit to Respond right now, I don't think it means anything. But the steering committee is taking that very seriously and is really moving toward more intentional ways of organizing and helping us to be more vocal. So it's really at the ground or at the very beginning of this, but I do see the potential for us and that congregations will be called into greater action. And some of that is education around what climate justice really is, and that this is connected to racial justice, is connected to refugee justice and immigration justice and economic justice, and helping people to make those connections.
So that's the kind of resources I have. The OurPowerCampaign.org outlines the principles of a just transition so that we know, like, what's a renewable and what's a renewable, you know, those kinds of educational things, and getting more of what's going on. And then the group that is organizing frontline communities is Grassroots Global Justice. And you can support them, but they're mainly for communities of color and the people who are most affected by climate change. So if you know a group in your area that is, on the front lines of change, connecting them with Grassroots Global Justice would be great as well. But I think for learning about the principles of just transition so that we know what we need to do to transition off of a fossil fuel-based economy, the website is ourpowercampaign.org.
That's great. That's great. I know some of our congregations are involved with the transitions movement. It might be fun to have them on as guests to talk about doing the things like Peggy's mentioning of growing food and canning and just doing all of that World War II type stuff, which, you know, as a gardener, I love that stuff. So, and I think the whole movement of food justice is really incredibly exciting on an urban level. I'm loving that. So next week, we're going to have Caitlin Breedlove, the new director of Standing on the Side of Love, with us, which is exciting. She comes in with, we'll find out what they're going to do. Thanks so much to Peggy and Shauna for being here, and regulars, you want to say goodbye?
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.